can't see without my glasses. Is anything moving here? Numbers?
No numbers moving.
Is anything moving?
No.
Is this a report? Okay, good.
It's what?
Does it say REC anywhere?
Yeah, it does.
It's going up. I can't believe it. Okay.
As you know, what is highlighted right here, when we are afforded the opportunity, speakers are to smell and taste our presence. One of the speakers that we always look forward to when we're the color is our percentage to make time for us in the schedule. So without further ado, it is our pleasure to welcome Ms. Brenda Keller.
Okay, we just fixed it up. I'm speaking for 8 hours, and no, not really. So I want to pose a question to you. We're going to be speaking about Hanukkah. I want you to go back there. So imagine Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. The Greeks conquered. So Greek culture was very attractive, and I'm going to tell you soon what was so attractive about it. But as you're listening, I want you to hear the question I'm going to ask you reverberate within you. Everybody in that era made choices. They may have made choices knowing that they were making choices, or they may have made choices not noticing that they were making choices. But here was the choice that everybody had to make. The choice was, am I a Misyaven or am I a Maccabi? So there are people who no doubt thought of themselves as neither. But the truth is that in their hearts, they're either here or there. Okay, so keep the question in the back of your mind, and now we'll start. So the first thing we're going to discuss is the concept of being either here or there. As you know, each person is considered to be like a miniature world. I'm sure you've heard the concept before, that the world is like one giant human being. Hashem is the heart of the world, and everything comes forth from there. Everything in nature, humans, everything. And each person is like a miniature world. So when you're trying to understand yourself, which, like when you're your age, people put some effort into doing, later you'll forget, okay? But when you're trying to figure out who you are, one of the models that you could look at is the creation story. So with that in mind, okay, the very beginning, the first thing, light and darkness, right? Okay, so there's a machloket in the Gemara between Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai. Which came first, light or darkness? Okay, you know the text. Make me the case for this, that light came first. Huh? Okay, it says, Bereshit bara Elokim et what? Shemayim va'aretz, and there was or and choshech. It seems very clear which came first. Make me a case that the earth with all of its darkness came first. Vayi erev, vayi boker. Va'aretz hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech. So they were arguing about this. Then Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai heard the two sides of the argument, and he said one of the most unusual statements in the whole Gemara. He said it doesn't matter. Okay, so let's understand the two sides of the machloket. There are two approaches to looking at what life is about. One is saying the primary thing is light, that which is heavenly, Torah, Tefillah, etc., which was the approach of Avraham. He would say, you know what this was all created for with all of its intricacy and wisdom? Is that we should see a little light. And he would give the light indiscriminately to anybody who was willing to receive it. There's another approach. The other approach is that what life is for is challenge. And therefore darkness has to pre-exist. Because there's enough light in the heavens before there was a world. This world is for challenge. This is the path of Yitzchak. So as you probably noticed in the Torah, or maybe you didn't, but whatever, in the Torah, the longest Yitzchak narrative is what? It's not the Akedah. The Akedah is considered an Avraham narrative. After all, it says, Velokim Nisat Avraham. What's the longest Yitzchak narrative? Mm-hmm. So the reason, I'll tell you why you don't remember it, because it's so puzzling. The longest Yitzchak narrative is about the wells. You remember this? Mm-hmm. He dug a well and the Plishtim filled it. And he dug another well and the Plishtim filled it. And he dug, okay, whatever. And you're thinking as you read this, yes? Okay. So what this narrative is about is that there's a whole other approach to spirituality. Instead of looking from the heavens for inspiration and bringing it down, you can look at the earth and be challenged by it and dig in it and not be afraid of it until you find water which gives life. That's called Gvura. So there are two different approaches. So what does that have to do with anything? So this machloket, Bet Hillel, Bet Shammai, Chesed, Gvura, what's life really about? So Rashbi says it doesn't matter, meaning there are going to be times when this is what you have to tap into, there are going to be times when that's what you have to tap into, you have to chart your course. So now let's go back to what we were talking about. The Greeks conquered Israel. And the Greek civilization was extremely attractive. What do you know about Greek civilization and its attraction?
Gyms.
Hmm?
They had gyms.
What? Well, everybody's into Gashmias. I mean, like, I'll put it illustrate to you how into Gashmias you are. I shouldn't do this, it's not nice. Okay. I have no verbal self-control, it's terrible. Okay, how many of you were ever on a diet? Okay. The rest of you are liars. Okay, whatever. So, in any case, pretend you were on a diet, right? 99% of you were never on a diet. Okay, but pretend you're on a diet. So here it is, you know, you get up in the morning and you look at yourself and you don't like what you see, so you say, I have to lose weight. So you get a diet book and you do what they say. The first thing they tell you is diets don't work. This is a food plan, not a diet. Okay, and you're supposed to take them seriously. Okay, so you eat fruit. So by 10 o'clock, are you hungry or not if all you had was fruit?
Yeah.
Of course. But it says right there in the book, you are not hungry. So you have 2 cups of water. Okay, then it's lunchtime. You have a salad and some steamed vegetables. And it's 4 o'clock. Are you very hungry? Yes, but it says that you're not, so you have more water. Okay, 6 o'clock, you're even hungrier. And you already had your fruit of the day, but don't worry, you're going to eat supper. You have a salad and steamed vegetables, and maybe your protein of the day. And by 10 o'clock, are you hungry? Very hungry, but it says that you're not, so you have 2 cups of water. And you know, diet should be combined with exercise. If you drink 16 cups of water in the day, believe me or not, you'll be exercising. Okay, back and forth, back and forth, whatever. But in any case, so here it is. So here it is. Eventually, you're going to hear a little voice. The voice will say, I really want something. I want a cracker. And there'll be an answering voice. You should stay on this diet, I mean food plan. Okay, so notice who's I and who's you. Right? I really want a cracker. You really shouldn't have one. What I is speaking? The physical self. So when you say the Greeks were into Gashmias, I want to change your perspectives. We're all into Gashmias. Let's not pretend we're not. Okay, is that true or not? Okay. Tell me more about the Greeks. They're focused on aesthetics. We have 2 things, gymnastics, aesthetics, anything else?
Philosophy.
Okay, so let's stay with these 3. Now, on the surface of things, this is not so attractive. How many of you ever felt a real yearning to know Greek philosophy? How many of you ever went to your parents and said, gosh, there's nothing to read. I looked at this week's Mishpacha and Bina, and I already read, I don't know what else you could read in America that's Jewish every week. I already read it. Could you get me Plato? Okay. What attracted them? Or working out. How many of you said, gosh, I would love to exercise like 6-7 hours a day? Okay, whatever. A few of you maybe. Okay. So I'll tell you what made the Greek world so attractive, because I want you to understand that these are offshoots of the attraction. This is at the core of the attraction. The Greek world is human-centered. The Jewish world is God-centered. So there are fancy words that describe this. The Greek world is described as ecocentric, which means human-centered. And the Jewish world is described as deocentric, which means God-centered. So here's how the human-centered world looks. If I think it's good, then it's what?
Good.
And moral, spiritual? What are you talking about? If it feels good to me, what is it?
Good.
If it looks good, what is it?
Good.
It's a completely different way of looking at the world, which is exactly the vision that we have in today's world, but in today's world it's called liberalism. So let's talk about the attraction of liberalism, because that's what it is. Liberalism is the human-centered world. Okay, if all people seem basically the same, then they must be what? Same. And if a person could do what the Torah calls an abomination, but they really want to, so who's to say that they're what?
Wrong.
And, you know, if you dress how you want, as long as you're not harming somebody else, who's to make you feel what? Guilt. That's the voice of the ecocentric world. So I want to take you back to its roots, and then we could talk about why so many people were attracted to it. Let's go back to the story of life after the flood. Noah planted a vineyard, as you know. Okay, he became drunk. His son Ham castrated him because he didn't want him to have more children. You have Shem and Yefet seemingly doing the same thing, but what they did was coming from a different place from within them. What did they both do? What did they do? What? They covered him. Were they respectful about it? Yes. What was Shem's point of access, and what was Yefet's point of access? They both see the terrible disgrace of their father. What was their point of access? Shem saw what happened as being wrong. Yefet saw what happened as being ugly. There's a huge difference between these views. Wrong implies that there is a purpose for living, and that there's a higher force, and that there's accountability. Ugly means it's not aesthetic. It's not pleasing to who? Me. Okay, that's the difference between Greek thought and Jewish thought. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Greek thought, but I want to start out by telling you, on an instinctive level, if you don't think, you just follow your gut, which is always more attractive? Jewish thought or Greek thought? Greek thought. Greek thought is a source of immediate gratification. It removes the burden of guilt. It's very attractive. To the point that Maharal points out that the word Yavan in Gematria is what? Yavan. Yud is ten. Nu? What?
56.
Okay. Thank you, 66. This took a little longer than one would have hoped, didn't it? Okay. The word Heichal is how much? He Yud Chaf Lamed. 65. Okay. I spared us all a lot of agony. Okay. So this, Maharal says, is to show us that when we're going from the outside in, which is what the written word is, the written word is the chitzonius of an idea, its outer shell. Of course Greek thought is more attractive. Okay, so now I want to move you more to current history. Okay, let's look at Europe in the late 1800s. There was a Neo-Greco movement called the Haskalah. Haskalah was the Enlightenment. The core of the Enlightenment was, if you think it's good, it's
good.
And if it feels good, it's
good.
And if there's restriction, it's
bad.
Okay. What percentage of Jews fell into that trap? throw a percentage number. 1%, 10%, 50%. At least 70%, directly or indirectly. Not everybody was a big thinker, and this is what I'm saying. Choice making isn't always conscious. Now let's move it to today. Forget about non-religious Jews, non-observant Jews, because today's non-observant Jews are non-observant not because they chose into it for the most part, but because that's what they were brought up with. My conservadox relatives just came by recently to my home in Yerushalayim, and they think of themselves as being very religious. So they were telling me that they attend synagogue every week, and my cousin works in Wall Street, the Chabad fellows come every day and he puts on tefillin. Of course, if they don't come one day, he doesn't. And they were leaving Israel on Shabbos because it was an emergency. They couldn't have their trip to Istanbul if they left on Friday. So it's, you know, it's an emergency. So people who think like this are not thinking Greek consciously. They're thinking Greek subconsciously. What are they thinking? Religion is good because what? It feels good. Religion is good because it feels good. As soon as it doesn't feel good, what isn't it? Not good. You understand this? Now, it's not their fault that they think that way. This is what they were brought up to think. But I want you to think of from people. Okay? There are people who are stronger and people who are weaker. The subconscious thought that make most people who are weak falter is that they're living in an egocentric world. Everything has to do with the self. So when you I find this interesting. I often say interestingly, then I watch people glaze over. But in Neve, around a third of the girls presently are girls who are from homes who were off the derech and are now coming back. So when I talk to them about what's the story, how did you end up where you ended up, I hear the same story in different nusachot, as they would say. I haven't yet met anybody who said, the reason why I left being observant was because I didn't buy into the telegraphic argument for the reality of God. That isn't it. I never met anybody who said, I'm not convinced that the Code of Hammurabi wasn't the original moral document. Okay, you know what they say? My parents didn't understand me. My teachers treated me badly. I didn't want to be part of the system. Do you know people like this? How many of you know people like this? So I want to point out to you, and it's not their fault, because we live in a liberal society and you breathe in the air of the society that surrounds you. Their problem is that they're living in an ecocentric world. If it feels good to me, then it's good. If it doesn't feel good to me, it's not good. So now I want you to question, and why would anybody go for a deocentric world? What's in it? Why go for a deocentric world? Why not just float through life and say, if it feels good, it is good. Like where? In California. Okay, whatever. So, okay, one of my students just told me that her true belief, she lives in California, is that LA stands for Lo Aleinu. But, so I want to tell you why. Okay, let's go back to the Bet Hillel Bet Shammai Machloket. Shemayim or Aretz, or Choshech. So the resolution, if you look at the text, is after it says, V'aretz hayta tohu v'vohu v'choshech al pnei tahom, what happened next? No? What happens next in the text? Do we go straight to the flood story? No. V'ruach Elokim mirachefet al pnei hamayim. The Spirit of Hashem hovers on the face of the waters. Meaning, no matter how dark your situation is, how unenlightened, there's a part of everybody, which is the Ruach Elohim in them, that wants goodness. Not just feeling good, but real goodness. So I want to illustrate this to you. I'm going to take you through an exercise that I've taken you through before, but you'll survive. Okay? Think of your favorite food. You there? What is it?
Ice cream.
Nobody ever said canned peas. Isn't that fun? Okay, whatever. Okay, gosh, what I wouldn't do for a can of peas. Okay, served at room temperature. Okay, so ice cream. Think of the best, think of your fantasy ice cream. You there? Not just ice cream, but fantasy ice cream. Okay. Nuts. Toasted coconut, cream, whatever it is that you like. Okay. How many of you could handle having your fantasy ice cream?
What?
You could cope with it. If you came home and they bought it and they said, have some, you could cope with it? Yeah, okay. How long does the pleasure last?
While
you eat it. So there's a reason for that. The reason isn't that the pleasure is illusory. It's not illusory. The reason is that the pleasure is shallow. Now, here's what I want to ask you that I didn't ask you in a previous time when I gave you the same exercise. Does everybody in the world know this?
No.
So I want to tell you something. Intellectually, everyone knows this. Emotionally, people don't know this. Could you see where this is so? Okay. The people who are willing to be honest with themselves emotionally, who are not necessarily the majority, want more. They still want this because it gives you pleasure, but they want more. They go on to the pleasure of beauty. Having gorgeous clothes, living in a beautiful home, going on nature trips, music, art, dancing. Think of your favorite beauty-oriented pleasure, which in fancy English is aesthetic pleasure. Shopping. Okay, now what's your favorite aesthetic pleasure? Shopping, okay. The honest person said shopping. The rest of you no doubt were thinking it's going to museums. Okay. So envision this. You find the perfect outfit and it's the right, or better still, you won a contest and now you could buy a Coach bag. That's the very chashuv one, right? Okay. Yes? Okay. Is there something more chashuv than that? There's a bag that's even more chashuv than that? No, so I maxed out a Coach bag. Okay, what's a great designer? No? Who? Prada. Tory Burch?
Yeah.
Okay, and everything else is from Tory Burch. So you have a Coach bag and everything else is from Tory Burch. And it looks great on you. Like, great! Okay, that would make you happy? Okay. Now, does the happiness last longer than ice cream?
Yes.
But there's a limitation. I want to tell you that the limitation is. The limitation is that there's a break between having and being. You could have a great outfit. You could have a great looking home. You could have a great experience. But you can't be it. So that means once the object you have is not in the picture, the pleasure is gone. Could you see where this is true?
Yeah.
Now, in Western society, which is very Greek-oriented, would you say most people know this?
Yeah.
Not even intellectually. Emotionally, almost no one knows it. It's a secret, okay? But intellectually, people don't even grasp that having and being aren't the same thing. The people who get it still want having, but they want more, and they go to the pleasure of relationship. So I want you to think of the person in the world who you like the best. I'm not going to ask who it is. You're thinking of the person who you like the best? Yes? I realize this is New York. The person who you dislike the least? Okay. Okay, here's what I'm going to ask you. What I'm going to ask you is not who the person is, but what you like about them. What do you like about the person you like the best? Yes, you're avoiding my eyes, but it's not going to help you. No, I'm being nasty. The girl in front of you. You, yes.
They're nice.
They're nice, okay. Yeah? She's smart. Anything else?
that I can trust her.
She's trustworthy. Yeah?
They're super talented.
Okay, good. And I'll throw in some others. Sensitive, kind, loyal. We like those traits?
Yes.
Those are all spiritual, aren't they? Are they spiritual or are they material? Could you weigh sensitivity or kindness, measure it?
No.
They're all spiritual. Now I want to ask you another question. When you're with them, if you feel the way you just described, if you feel loyal, kind, talented, interesting, do you like them even better? That's called spiritual connection. Spiritual connection is what gives us the highest pleasure, and I want to tell you why, because it has to do with being. What kills spiritual connection is non-movement, where you don't extend yourself to another person, where you don't discover the good in you, and the other person doesn't. In a Greek society, there's not much room for goodness, because everybody is into what? Pleasure. The direction of pleasure is always taking. The direction of goodness is always giving. So now let's talk about how it was actually to live in Israel during the time of the Greeks. Do you think the majority of Jews were Hellenists or Maccabim, at least at the beginning? Where were the majority? Definitely Hellenists. Okay, the word Hellenist means pro-Greek. People saw themselves as Hellenists. Interestingly, the more oppressive the Greeks became, the more questions the Jews asked themselves. So as you know, the Greeks forbade Shabbos. They forbade Brit Milah. They forbade Rosh Chodesh. Where were they coming from? Who cares if somebody else keeps Shabbos? Why were they so opposed to Shabbos? So I want to tell you something. I want you to go back and you could speak to your grandparents about this. Maybe they would have had to speak to your great-grandparents. There was a time not that long ago when being Shomer Shabbos in America was extremely difficult. Have you heard about this from your grandparents? So I want to tell you that there was a time when the work week was 6 days and the day off was Sunday, and it was virtually impossible to find a normal Shomer Shabbos job. All of the jobs that people found were some a little bit abnormal. They could either have their own businesses, which requires at least some degree of capital to begin with, or they had to do odd jobs. But that was it. You couldn't work in a store. You couldn't work in an office. It wasn't so simple. You had great personalities who were forced to do ridiculous jobs to keep their families alive. Rav Schwab, the Rav of the Kehillah in Washington Heights at one point, was selling vacuum cleaners door to door, because he had to put food on the table. So in that era, if you were to ask the Jewish employers, forget about the non-Jews, how come you keep your business open 6 days a week? What would they say?
To make money.
People do their shopping on Saturday. And if you would say, what do you need so much money for? What would that be? To buy pleasure. You understand this? That's Greek think. So the reason why the Greeks had to oppose Shabbos is that the basic statement of Shabbos is what? If you had to tell somebody who's not religious, this is what Shabbos is for, what would you say?
Put away everything physical.
What?
Put away everything physical and just
day of rest.
Okay. Well, if it's just rest, you could rest on Sunday. It has to do with moving away from your self-centrality, not doing, not creating, and moving into being and connecting. You understand this? This was antithetical to Greek thought. Kedusha, which means transcending, going above physical limitations, is above Greek thought. The whole idea of not doing malachas on Shabbos. You're allowed to jump up and down endlessly if that's what you would choose to do. But you can't do malacha. The word malacha has to do with making creative efforts. Turning on a light when it was dark. You have to say, I'm not the creator, God's the creator. You make spiritual connection. The Greeks opposed Brit Milah. What do they care if somebody else circumcises their child. Now, I want you to give this answer some thought. As you may know or may not know, there's a significant movement, significant but not populist at this point, of people who oppose Brit Milah. There are states in which they would like to see this illegal. What would they have against Brit Milah? What's unethical about it? Well, everything you do a baby is by force. You know, like the baby, you can't say, would you like to eat, wouldn't you like to eat, would you like to be changed, wouldn't you like to be changed? It's painful, but then again, babies don't like being washed either. What? Oh, you've got it. They say you're taking away the choice from the baby to have a perfect body or an imperfect body. This is what they say. What would be the Jewish answer? Again, somebody who's not religious, well-intended, says, what do you people do this for? What would you say? Oh, it shows that we believe that it's possible to have connection in a way in which you're taking your body with you. We don't think the connection is up there and we are down here. We believe in taking your body with you on the path to connection. Which is, by the way, what differentiates Judaism from virtually every other religion. Now, what can anybody have against Rosh Chodesh? It's so innocuous. Who cares? Some guy is on a hill and he's going like... And then there, you know, more hills, and then they all say Mekudesh, Mekudesh. So what? Who cares?
Because it gives the rabbanim the ability to control time, which means that they have... Which one is it, yesterday?
Good. I'm glad that one person remembers it if you just learned it yesterday.
It seems that they have the ability to control nature and...
Okay, it means that we see time as something that exists for human purpose and definition. Give me a reasonable definition of time. Suppose I came from Turkey and I didn't know the word time. What would you say time means?
A measurement of how the days pass.
A measurement of change. You're close. So saying relevant change, you know, some of you, no doubt, have heard that there's something called newspapers. You've heard of them? Okay. And there's even media news, CNN, all of this. Now, when you read a newspaper, somebody decides what they think is relevant and important. Okay. Obama faces difficulty in Senate, for instance. Now, if there were newspapers in the ancient world, would the Akedah make the picture, the paper?
Yeah.
Doubt it. Who saw it? Avram and Yitzchak. Young girl gives much water to itinerant traveler. Okay? So their picture of what's newsworthy, what defines the course of change, has to do with the ecocentric world. Does it feel good to me? Will it affect me? Etc. The Jewish view is, it spiritually important? So a lot of Jews did choose to go with the Maccabim, and as time went on, more and more made that choice. What drove them was what? Why did they abandon Hellenism and move towards Judaism? I'll tell you why. They came to the realization that nothing gives joy like connection, and nothing provides connection like the mitzvot and a relationship to God. They came to that conclusion. They saw the lack of morality in the Hellenistic world and the lack of joy. So tricky thing is, in the human-centered world, there's not much simcha. Have you noticed this yet? Or are you too young to have seen it? People think, wow, if there were fewer restrictions, I'd be happy. It's not true. If there are fewer restrictions, there's no meaning, no goal, no anything that keeps you going on the inside. So I'm going to conclude by wishing you that you think forward and think more deeply about what light would really mean to you in your life and how you could make connections. So I'm going to close now and ask for questions if you have any. Hint, hint. Okay. No questions? Yeah?
How does that connect to what came first, the light or the darkness?
So again, it connects to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's answer, which is, there are people, how does this connect to what we said at the beginning about light and darkness? There are two ways to find meaning. One is to discover light, and the other is to find light in the midst of darkness. The way that the Jews had to discover light at Chanukah was in the midst of darkness. They had to be able to redefine the ecocentric world as dark before they could look for light. Which is why Chanukah has to take place in the darkest days of the year.
So then isn't that kind of the same, because they have to discover light in the dark? So not really two different things.
They're two different paths. In other words, Yitzchak can't possibly have, he couldn't have come into being without Avram preceding him, because we'd have to know what light is. But it's one thing to give light indiscriminately, and it's another to dig it out and reject. Avram wasn't rejectionist. That isn't Midas HaGvura. Arguably, that's why Ishmael came from him, but that's another story. Yitzchak was willing to say not only this yes, but that no, which is a different sort of approach. But you have to be able to say first this yes before you could meaningfully say that no.
Right. But didn't Avram say that also because he's the one who stood up against the world and said what the world is doing now?
Yes and no. In other words, he did do that. That's why he's called Ha'ivri. Ivri means from the other side. The whole world was on one side, he was on the other side. But his approach in general was to change the world by displaying what goodness is rather than confronting evil. He was forced into going into the fiery furnace. He didn't invite the situation to arise. So the whole nature of Gvuras Yitzchak is seen in two places. She asks, where do you see Yitzchak's Gvura? Where do you see it in the text? So there are two main sources. One, and I find this very interesting, is that the Akedah was not called his Nisayon. It's Ve'elokim Nisa et Avraham, not et Avraham v'et Yitzchak. Now he was 37 at the time of the Akedah. He wasn't this like nebby little kid who's saying, where are we going? You know, whatever. Okay, so to him, the idea of giving up physical life for Hashem's will wasn't even in a Sayon. It wasn't on the page. This is how he had been living. This is how he continued to live. His life was about saying no in order to say yes. So giving up his life was not even in a sign. It went with the flow of his personality and his choices. The other place, and this is more subtle, which is why you'd know this Derech Drash, Derech Sod, is through the stories of the well. That they had to contend with digging up and saying, not Sitna, not Eshek, until you have Rechovot, until you have the broad place. Okay, yeah? Okay, so what made the Jews change? So there were two things, and this characterizes our exile very strongly. The first is, and unfortunately, it's part of human nature. A lot of the times you have to figure out who you're not and what you don't want to be before you could figure out who you are and what you do want to be. So the nature of seeing the hollowness of Greek civilization up close, seeing its extreme immorality, seeing the lack of true connection, affected many Jews. And the more oppressive the Greeks were, the more the Jews recognized this. So this is why, for instance, when you look in the tshuva world, oftentimes the people who come back are the people who've had very successful lives, who thought that they got to where you can get in society, and then they say, you know what, it's not that great. It's pretty empty. What Makarov's people, and this is the other side of it, if you ask anybody who drew closer to Judaism, not necessarily the central factor, but certainly a central factor, is the Shabbos table, where they see connection, and they also see self-transcendence in getting past the need to do malacha. So the Jews similarly saw the hollowness of the Greek civilization, and they were affected deeply by the Mesiras Nefesh of the Chashmonaim, which opened up the door to seeing new possibilities in themselves. So the reason why this opens up the door to new possibilities, which is a subject in itself, but I'm going to give you a shorter answer than your question deserves, is because Hashem made a brit with the Avos. He said, your children will be like you, meaning they lived lives that were bigger than life, so something of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are within us. When the people saw the Mesiras Nefesh of the Chashmonaim, there was something inside that resonated that said, yes, and that had an enormous effect on them. Yeah. How come we could learn from what? Yes, yeah. If you what? The same gematria?
Usually one of the masters and one of the house, you learn, like, you could ever mean the same thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So here we're seeing they're different, but they're similar
to that. Right, so even though when people play with gematria, there is an idea that you can count the word itself in the gematria, so it could be off by one. That's true. Here, you have two, which are not the same. In other words, if we were to say that Heichal equals 65, and we could take one off Yavan to make it equal 65, that would be fine. But they're not the same. You can't add the one and not add the one. That doesn't work. So, I don't know who you mean by we, but Bal HaTurim doesn't do that very much. Usually he does that with...
I know we've found the masters that don't want to pay.
No, you have gematrias that are one apart. You'll say this word is the same as that word, right? This equals that. But you're not using a word that's in a text and comparing it to another word that's in a text when the gematrias are different and being told that it's the same. Well, the resonance here is that they're both words that are used textually in Daniel and elsewhere. Yeah? I don't hear the end. I heard if we hear the Hellenists, and I didn't hear the rest of what you said. So, you asked a good question, and I'm going to tell you the answer. This relates to the question that the other girl asked, which is what turned the Jews around. Everyone is in Hashem's image, but not everyone has access to it. Hashem promised the Avos that no matter how far a Jew goes, there's always a part of that Jew that resonates to what the way the Avos were. The chesed of Avraham, his desire to do good and be good, Yitzchak's gvura, his ability to say no to what's not true, and Yaakov's sense of the broadness of truth. There's no such promise to non-Jews. A non-Jew could find it or not find it. A Jew, by the nature of things, is discontent in the long run with anything that's untrue. Now, I want to illustrate this I want to take this one step further. The way happiness works is people like to do what they can do. Could you see where this is true? Like if you have an artist and you say, I don't let you paint, they'll be unhappy. If you have somebody who's musical and you say, I don't let you play your instruments, they'll be unhappy. Is that true or not? But if you have an artist and you say, you can't play the instrument, they'll be fine. Okay? So Jews have souls that are so strong that they can even enter the material world and lift it up, and without that they're not content. So I want you to picture two people, me and Arad. Do you all know who Arad is? Okay, I thought so. Okay, and the teacher's just like, who's Arad? He's a chashuv baseball player, I asked somewhere else. Okay, this is, I know about Arad, I know about Coach Biggs, I ask people. So, suppose there was no wall over here, and me and Arad were standing here together, and somebody says, both of you could throw a ball as far as you could. So I take the ball and I throw it as far as I could. How far will it get?
Very far.
Me? I'd say maybe to the girl who's wearing the white shirt with the long hair. Okay, that's like, okay, how far will Arad's ball go if there was no wall there? We'll get to Brooklyn. Okay, whatever. So the rule is the stronger the pitch, the further the ball goes. Jews have a need to live lives of meaning. It's in the blood. Even secular Jews are often active in liberal causes in which they think they're bettering the world because they need to do something of meaning. Greeks don't, unless they discover that part of themselves. That's why there's a difference.
Kind of, don't we have an unfair advantage? Because how can you discredit them for anything?
So, you asked a good question, which, as you noticed, I didn't say, but I'm sorry. Okay. So, good question is, what about the unfair advantage it gives Jews? The covenant Hashem made that guarantees that there will be something in us that wants more, is that not unfair? You ready for an answer? Yes. Yes, it's unfair. Yes, it's unfair. What mitigates the unfairness is that any non-Jew who wants this can get on. Any non-Jew who says, but I want to be a Jew, okay, I want more, will say...
Have that.
No, but as they said, they could choose to discover it. It could be completely concealed, but because they are... Non-Jews are also spiritual beings, as you observe. If they choose to discover it, that could take them either to being a tzaddik amongst the non-Jews or to conversion. But there's no door that's closed. Okay, yeah? So the Jews and okay. So I would say, first of all, that most Jews are seekers. They just don't know how to seek. So I'll illustrate this to you. The amount of charity in the United States given by Jews is so far beyond the amount given by non-Jews that it's off the chart. Another, I was reading in this week's Newsweek. They had an article about the Jewish Museum that's been recently opened in Philadelphia. It's opened by secular Jews, so you can imagine, who were the Jewish heroes, you tell me? Einstein. Who else? Pseudo-Einsteins, the Nobel Prize winners. Okay, the comedians, the Jewish comedians, the Jewish moguls. But even they had to take notice of this. There were like so many Jewish Nobel Prize winners and philanthropists, and only one Jewish Miss America. that they took notice that there seemed to be paths the Jews don't take. The amount of Jews involved in the liberal movements, which they believed to be movements towards spiritual meaning, Abby Hoffman, Bob Dylan, there's a reason why these are Jewish names. Jews, secular Jews, definitely see it. They just have no idea that what they're doing isn't going to take them to where they want. When the communist movement arose in Russia at the beginning of the century, it was a Jewish movement. Let's not deceive ourselves. There were a lot of jokes about this. My family is Russian b'makor, about looking for a minion in the Kremlin, etc. But it was a Jewish movement. The problem, and this is a problem we have to face, could be under... Do you have time? Because I want to tell you a story.
Yeah, we have time.
Okay. Okay. So I want to take you back to the early part of last century. Okay, the Gra predicted 100 years before that the time of return to Eretz Yisrael had begun, which is why he sent his Talmidim to live in Eretz Yisrael. They were the first Hityashvut since the temple's destruction. He predicted it, and soon the movement fell into the hands of secularists who thought that they could build a nation like other nations in Eretz Yisrael. But they were drawn, for reasons that they themselves couldn't describe, to doing this in Eretz Yisrael and not elsewhere. Today, Jews tried to build meaning for themselves, for instance, in the United States. Then they were doing it in Israel. So the direction of the two yeshuvs, the descendants of the students of the Gra and the Hasidim who came in its wake, and the early secular Zionists were like this. They had no communication. So two of the very powerful leaders of the time, Rav Zonnenfeld and Rav Kook, joined together, and they decided to visit every kibbutz and moshav to try to get the people to do tshuva. Now, Rav Zonnenfeld was a very good speaker. He could rivet people. Rav Kook was not that good a speaker, but he was a man of ideas. So they went together. Now picture this combination, a great thinker and a great speaker. Do you think that that could move people? They failed miserably. When they came back to Yerushalayim, and they just said, like, what did we accomplish these 2 months? The answer was, not much. So they both came to different conclusions based on a similar reality. The similar reality is that they both admitted this was a failure. That means that presently the people are not reachable. They didn't blame themselves. It wasn't if you could only speak better, if you could only think better. That wasn't the problem. The people weren't reachable. So Rav Kook's view was they're not reachable now, but ultimately the land will draw them back. Okay, Rav Zonnenfeld's view was the people are not reachable now, so we have to create communities that are so inviting and attractive that when people want to come back, they'll come back. Historically, I'm not saying this is a judgment against anyone, clearly Rav Zonnenfeld's view has prevailed. I don't see masses of people coming back because they're in the land, although I do have to say that the great tshuva movements are in Eretz Yisrael, not anywhere else. So apparently the land's hashpa is real. But what draws people back are communities that are inviting and attractive. So one of the problems of why people are not all drawn back is our communities are not as inviting as they might be, and tragically not as attractive as they might be. So what you have to do if you want to get us out of Golas Yavan in its Romanesque incarnation is to live a life of Kiddush Hashem. If you live a life of Kiddush Hashem, you'll see people coming back because they don't have anything. Okay, yeah? And what has to exist?
Dark.
Yes.
I don't,
you don't understand?
The correlation.
Okay, you give me an example of any person who you would consider to be heroic. Any hero, alive, dead, any hero.
I just
say it? Yeah. Okay. Wow! Okay. Okay. Now, I don't know her real eyes, so I can even do this sincerely. So I said, I don't know Rebbetzin Hertz. What's so heroic about Rebbetzin Hertz? What would you say?
I'm walking out.
Do you want to choose? Do you want to get yourself off the hook and choose someone more famous and anonymous? Want to get yourself off the hook and choose somebody more famous and less directly? I ask somebody else. No. Yeah. Well, think. Any hero will be broad. Any hero. Who? A person. Who? A person. Don't tell me charity or Hatzalah or kindness. Tell me a heroic person. No? You can't think of any heroic person?
Superman.
A mother.
Well, think. I'm not letting go. Who? I can't hear you. Scully? I have no idea who Scully is. Oh, great. Excellent. The pilot, his name is Scully?
Solly.
Okay, so the pilot who successfully landed the plane and saved all of the people on the plane. How many of you will agree that that's heroic? Okay. Now, suppose you found out it was all a scam. He wasn't really on the water, it was just filmed that way. Really, he just landed it on the landing strip in LaGuardia. Would he still be a hero?
Yeah.
No. So it makes ordinary pilot lands plane on landing strip. Okay. So what makes him heroic is the difficulty of the challenge that he had to overcome. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
So no challenge, no darkness, no difficulty equals no heroism. Got it? Okay. Again, no challenge, no darkness, no difficulty equals no heroism. And this would be true of any hero you would have chosen. I'm glad somebody said that is true. I'm so happy. I love affirmation. Okay. Nothing like validation. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah?
Okay. So we said before that
it depends on what they choose as headlines. So sometimes it's political.
What was the question?
So she said, I pointed out that headlines usually delineate and highlight things that are of little importance. So I'll give you an example, a Jewish example and a non-Jewish example and a Jewish example. A non-Jewish example, Obama will now have difficulty in Congress. Okay, clear? Now, go back 200 years. Is it very likely that 200 years there were also politicians who had difficulty ruling?
Yeah.
Go back 500 years. Is it also okay? Go back 1,000 years. Is it possible? Go back 2,000 years. Julius Caesar, no, that would have to be even more than that. 2,500 years. Julius Caesar loses majority in Senate. Okay, does anybody in the world today care about this?
No.
So I want to tell you why. It's not important. Got it? So Jewish newspapers also sometimes write headlines about things that are not important. I don't know the political scene in America so much, but assemblyman whatever, lose a seat to what assemblyman whatever. Trust me, this is not going to make it to the scroll that Mashiach will write. However, let's say a consequence of that is that assemblyman whatever gets money to yeshivas, and the result of that is young boy gets to study Torah. And the result of that is Posek attributes greatness to having had opportunity to study as a child. That could make headlines. Okay.
Thank you, Rebbetzin Heller, and hopefully that gives us an additional meaning to the Yom Kippur that we're about to celebrate of Hanukkah. Okay, girls, it is now 10 o'clock. You're in the middle of second verse. It's really going, we're doing first, second, and third this morning, so you're heading up to your first period class. Okay, have a great morning. Thank you.
By Captain Sully. That's the thing about Captain Sully.